Every story told has a story of its own.
She said the words, I won't forget it. What more do you want from me?
It was on the fly decision making. It was drinking water from a fire hose at that point.
Every now and then, someone at a place like the grocery store might say something like, I'm glad you're holding MPS accountable. That keeps my fire burning.
Bringing you the story behind the story. This is Reporter's Notebook. Now, here's your host, Adam Roberts.
Welcome to Reporter's Notebook, where we take a deeper look at the biggest stories from the past week told from the perspective of reporters in the field, while also closer examining stories that deserve a deeper look. I'm Adam Roberts. Thanks, as always, for joining me on the show, and we've got another excellent one for you today. Coming up on the program, WTMJ's Jessica Gatzow recently went airborne to get the story, quite literally. And we'll both hear that story and also talk about her process in covering the story she was working on with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Also, really excited for this conversation, music and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Piet Levy, joins me on the show to talk a bit about the health of our concert scene in Milwaukee and also the role of the music reviewer in the modern media age, where seemingly anyone who uploads videos on YouTube has the ability to offer their perspective and thoughts on albums or concerts, but why someone like Piet is in a unique position to offer even more perspective given his years of experience. We'll dive into all of that coming up later on in the show. But first, I want to revisit something I teased on last week's episode. I mentioned that I was going to be part of a Milwaukee Press Club media panel speaking with new director of the Milwaukee Office of Community Wellness and Safety, Adam Purcell. By now, you've likely heard Purcell's story, but if you haven't, he brings a unique perspective to an office that has seen a lot of change at the top director position over the years. The office used to be known as the Office of Violence Prevention. The name was changed a few years ago, given its large public perception as an office named that, the Violence Prevention Office, that was unable to fully prevent violence. So they reorganized a little bit how they wanted to put emphasis in certain areas, and you have the new name Office of Community Wellness and Safety. Anyway, Purcell's background has been widely publicized, but if you didn't know, the man is a convicted murderer. Convicted of first-degree intentional homicide in the 1995 death of Robert Bruce in an act of gang violence here in Milwaukee. Purcell spent multiple years behind bars, including time in a supermax here in Wisconsin, and has since reintegrated into society after serving his time. He's now the CEO of Paradigm Shift and holds this new position within the city of Milwaukee. But of course, a lot of people with hard questions for Purcell, given his background, as well as surrounding the selection process that put Adam in the position he's currently in. He was, notably, not one of three finalists for the OCWS job. There were three who went through a public hearing process, had to speak with members of the community, but Purcell was appointed by Mayor Cavalier Johnson in August to much fanfare for both reasons I just mentioned. So naturally, it was a very interested crowd that came to the Newsroom Pub in downtown Milwaukee this past Monday. I, along with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's David Clary and Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service's Devin Blake, served on the panel. And we had a lot of those, as Purcell likes to call them, uncomfortable questions, such as this one.
Take me inside the mind of someone who is drawn to end someone's life. And utilizing that information and the lived experience you have, how can then we use that knowledge to attack violence at the root?
Well, you weren't lying about a tough, uncomfortable question. And thank you. And I think that's as uncomfortable as it is for me, because every single time I'm asked that or I look in that, I'm immediately transported back to those moments when I set a course of action, right? On September 26, 1995, I didn't have the mindset to take somebody's life. I had the mindset of, I want to impress this older gang member that was asking me to do things that I knew were wrong. I'm not trying to say that I didn't know, but I so desperately wanted to impress these older individuals that I sort of stuffed down my knowledge of what's right and what's wrong. If you have somebody with their gun in their hand and they're pulling a trigger, or even a couple moments before then, you've already lost the battle. I think you would have had to have gone back at least a year and started addressing my mindset then. As soon as I started to connect with those groups, that's when you have to intervene.
During our conversation, Purcell also brought up that there's been a lot of talk behind the scenes at City Hall towards reorienting how the Office of Community Wellness and Safety is set up, potentially changing it from Office of to Department of, thereby giving members of the Milwaukee Common Council more control over confirming or possibly rejecting candidates for the director position, something that currently does not exist.
They don't know if I'm grandfathered in or will I have to be confirmed by the Common Council. So now they would get their chance to, if they don't like me, if they don't like what I've done, in a couple of weeks, I theoretically couldn't have a job.
Mayor Johnson has until this upcoming Tuesday, November 18th, to veto any possible amendments to his city budget where this legislation is included. Then it will bounce back to the Common Council, who has the ability to override some of those vetoes. Regardless of how you feel about Purcell as a human being or him being selected to this highly publicized office that, despite the name change, does still put emphasis on preventing violence, I do appreciate his candor at this event. He didn't turn away any questions we asked. Nothing at all was vetted. And the audience also was very receptive to his responses to all of our questions. I have said it before on the show, and I'll say it again. If you do have an opportunity to attend any of these Milwaukee Press Club luncheon events, I highly recommend it. They can be very informative. As we've seen in the past, they can be hard-hitting and at times awkward and uncomfortable, but in a good way, because hard questions are being asked and hard answers are being given. So again, I highly recommend, if you haven't been to an event in the past, check out the Milwaukee Press Club's website for when they'll have another newsmaker luncheon. They typically do one a month, though I don't think they have one yet on the docket for this upcoming December. It's been quite a busy year in Wisconsin when you think about natural disaster events in 2025. At the very beginning of the year, we had, as a result of a warmer winter, early spring wildfires fueled in large part by drought conditions across the state. Then that moved into an above-average tornado season across Wisconsin. And to cap everything off, we had a 1,000-year flood in southeast Wisconsin, particularly impacting the city of Milwaukee. Much of the disaster mitigating and data collecting in our constantly changing climate falls to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they couldn't do any of it without a special support system from above. WTMJ's Jessica Gatzow has more.
Clear prop!
Pilot Nikki Gaskins shouts a safety warning before starting the engine of her Cessna 180. A few minutes later, with headphones on and runway cleared, she's flying about 1,000 feet above Wisconsin's farm fields, forests, and waterways.
We're up there for an array of different reasons to give that bird's eye view and help provide safety of everyone around.
Gaskins is one of nine pilots in the DNR's aeronautics program. It's a job that changes by the season and the day, or sometimes by the hour. Their customers are the people, plants, and animals of Wisconsin, with missions varying from search and rescue for a missing kayaker to tracking the inevitable springtime wildfires.
We can let them know what direction the fire is going. If some embers land, you know, ahead or on the side of the fire, they can start burning a secondary fire in another location, so we'll watch for that to happen. We'll scout ahead to see if the fire is heading towards, you know, any structures.
I'm continually impressed on our ability to bring different players to the same table with the same goal to respond to, let's say, the floods in Milwaukee.
Paul Christensen is the aeronautics program section chief. He surveyed southeast Wisconsin's flood damage back in August.
We went up, took geo-reference photos from the air, meaning that every time they clicked the shutter on the camera, that picture had a specific GPS coordinate or location associated with it.
All those photos become a digital archive of the pilot's bird's eye view.
When they landed, we're able to take that digital disc and hand it off to another member of another team, and all these photos get digitally organized. So then you start building this visual story timeline, perhaps a bend in the river in downtown Milwaukee, and I can click right on it and I can see all of that damage.
Aerial surveys save lots of time and money for emergency responses and for scientists.
I do a lot of aerial surveying because I can almost survey all counties in my area in 2 days. It would take me probably years to do that from the ground.
Bill McNee is a forest health specialist for Southeast Wisconsin. He goes up with a DNR pilot a few times a year to reach places that are otherwise difficult to access.
A lot of the swamps, for example, are just realistically not accessible in the summer. The leaves are on, that's when they should be green, and if they're not green, you're up above in an airplane and you can see that there is a problem.
McNee monitors how forests recover from flooding or fires and keeps an eye on tree pests and diseases.
The foliating insect, the spread of the emerald ash borer. On occasion, if we spray state lands for spongy moth or other defoliators with an airplane.
The Cessna planes can even help repopulate a forest.
It's actually a machine. It's a seeder, so they'll actually drop seeds out of the airplane as they're flying. So they're kind of flying pretty low, pretty slow, so those seeds get a good distribution.
One of Gaskin's favorite days on the job involves monitoring future feathered pilots.
So we'll actually go locate the eagle's nests, see if an eagle's sitting on it, and then go back a month later, see if chicks have hatched in them.
Pilots like Christensen and Gaskins say their job is one of the most rewarding types of flying.
It's on the other end of the spectrum of a Delta Airlines pilot. It's a different type of flying, actually flying the airplane, right? No autopilot, no climbing the 30,000 feet and flying from point A to point B. So really hands-on.
It's also a competitive field with natural resources and at times lives at stake.
These are some of the best pilots in the nation when it comes to natural resources flying. They come from all backgrounds and they make a really good team.
For WTMJ News, I'm Jessica Gatso.
I recently was also doing a story where I had to go thousands of feet in the air for a 128th refueling fly along. Tell me, first of all, you're not afraid of flying, are you?
No.
Because
I
have some issues with turbulence, but when a military jet's flying, it's super smooth. Was that the case also with the smaller craft?
To me, it was a very smooth ride. Maybe some minor bumps here and there. But overall, I don't have a problem with heights and certainly not a problem with looking out the window and being very aware of just how far up in the sky you are.
So, yeah, how far up did they say how many thousands of feet you were to get
only
this
about
view?
Only about 1,000 feet
okay.
for most of the time. And actually, sometimes it's very low. There's some occasions when pilots need to fly as low as just 200 feet above the ground, which is another interesting experience because you're still going at quite a speed, but you're seeing more detail in that way.
So, and you mentioned the detail, and as I was viewing some of the photos you have from this experience that the DNR shared, which you can view on WTMJ.com, I'll also throw a link to Jessica's story on our webpage. But there is so much intimate detail that this program captures. One of the images that stuck out to me was of aerial views of a tornado damage zone in northern Wisconsin from, I think it was 2007. Can you speak at all to just how significant being able to cover that wide of an area and get intimate detail is from the sky?
It's very significant for both time and money. The time it takes to do an aerial survey rather than survey something from the ground is a matter of days versus weeks and months, depending on the situation. And as far as money goes, I was talking with one of the scientists, forestry scientists, and he said it takes maybe something like $1,000 to take a couple of flights to get everything he needs for an entire year's worth of data for tree health.
And that's important because, as you mentioned in your feature, one of the more recent examples of this service being utilized was during our historic flooding here in Milwaukee in August. And everyone wants to get relief and everyone wants to get support, but that process starts somewhere with just understanding how wide of the scope the damage was. And this program really played a big part in that.
It did. Those pilots were up there flying for agencies like FEMA and, of course, your local municipalities as well to really get that picture of the damage. And that's exactly what agencies use to determine things like funding.
One other area I wanted to touch on with you, Jessica, because we're dealing with a story about planes, and that brings so many different variables into the equation. It's not just as simple as take off, take pictures, come back down. One of those variables is just air traffic. You know, we have so many planes, even amidst the government shutdown and the drop in air traffic, there's still hundreds and thousands of planes in the air at any given time. Did you encounter any issues with air traffic at all when you were covering the story?
I wouldn't say I necessarily encountered any issues, but it was definitely an interesting experience to be quite literally next to the pilot's seat. Because in a small aircraft, you know, there's only about four seats in these Cessna planes, and everything is a window seat. So I could hear our pilot, Nikki Gaskins, giving all of the communications to air traffic as we took off and we landed. So there wasn't a lot of communication to be had since we were in West Bend for that flight, not a very busy airport by any means, but still makes one appreciate sort of the intricacies of taking even just a short 20, 30 minute flight for an afternoon.
WTMJ's Jessica Gatzow, great stuff. And again, if you want to go over Jessica's feature in full, we'll include a link to that on Reporters Notebook's main page on WTMJ.com. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing now our sort of semi-regular series, the Get to Know You series, where I invite someone from the industry in who I haven't had on the show before to learn a little bit more about what makes them tick, how they got to where they are in their career now, and dig a little bit into what they know about their area of specialty. And so today I'm pleased to be joined by music and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is Piet Levy with me on Reporter's Notebook. Piet, welcome in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So right off the bat there, I laid it out, as I do with everyone who comes in for this, again, semi-regular series. Walk me through how you got to where you are right now, your journey up to this point, as far back as you can remember.
Sure. I mean, as a kid, I really loved entertainment. I was really interested in movies specifically. And I remember as a kid, like in, you know, third grade or so, reading a lot of entertainment coverage. I grew up in Dallas. So in the Dallas Morning News, I'd read like a lot of movie reviews and entertainment coverage there. And I would start to write my own reviews that I would pass around to my family. And they, you know, kept encouraging me. And I just loved writing so much. And it just kind of continued where in high school I, you know, was at the high school paper and editor of the paper. And then in college, one of the first things I did too was join the college newspaper. And, you know, again, writing a lot about movies. But in college, I kind of developed more of a love and appreciation for music and did more music writing as well in college. And there was our mentor for the college newspaper. He worked at the Chicago Tribune. And he, you know, in our first meetings, he said, you know, there might be opportunities for you guys to freelance for the Tribune, which seems extremely exciting for me to try to do. So I just kept working on it till he gave me that shot. So I started doing like freelancing for the Chicago Tribune and worked for a newspaper there called Red Eye as an intern. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ended up being an intern at the freelancing for the Dallas Morning News and an intern for a news station in Dallas and all these different kinds of things. And then I was an intern for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in 2005. That was right out of college. I didn't even have like a job prospect the day I graduated. I was going to, you know, try and maybe go to school, but I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. And an internship was offered to my roommate who had already taken a job. So he just talked me up. And that day, the day I graduated, I was just talking to editors. Many of them are still there about my qualifications. And I got the internship that day, the day I graduated from college. And that was like really, in hindsight, that really became a life-changing thing for me because I really loved, even though I was born in Dallas, my first memories were in Milwaukee. My family lived in Milwaukee. My dad was in medical school and we were here. And so I remember Milwaukee as a kid. Then we went to Dallas when I was like 8, and then really loved being back in Milwaukee, loved the city, really loved working for the Journal Sentinel as an intern. It's also where I met a woman who would become my wife, and we have 3 kids. And so I just loved the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I loved my internship and really wanted to come back full time. And in 2012, I finally got that opportunity. There was an opening for music writing. It was an area that they really you know, through buyouts and things, some music reporters had left, and there was a lot of things happening in the music scene in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. This is right when Bon Iver was really blowing up, and they really felt like they needed someone to cover music full time. And 2012, I was lucky to be given that opportunity, and have really treasured it ever since.
Yeah, you mentioned it. Our city, and you've written about this in the past, like, we are, I think, for those who've lived here their whole life and don't have outside experience, would be shocked when they see comparatively how music scenes, compared to what we have here, aren't as big as you might imagine. Like, right here, we are very blessed, and obviously we have a 3-weekend-long big gig, world's largest music festival, Summerfest, whatever you want to call it, that exists. And we'll talk more about the festival environment in just a moment. But yeah, it really is, I think, shocking when you leave Milwaukee and go somewhere of similar size, and you realize, wow, we actually have quite a bit going on in our city.
Yeah, and it's really grown since I've been here as a full-time reporter. I mean, back in 2012, that was when the Bradley Center was still here. I remember one of my first years, like, they had maybe 3 concerts one year. I did a story about that. You know, and the Miller High – now it's the Miller High Life Theater. I think then it was the Milwaukee Theater. Their bookings were pretty sporadic. The BMO Pavilion was just getting built at Summerfest. They were starting to go through more kind of renovations and things. It's really just skyrocketed since then. Like, the number of tours and shows and new venues that have come through, and the, you know, the Pfizer Forum and the remodeled amphitheater, and now we've got the Landmark Credit Union Live coming in February, and clubs have kind of come as well. I mean, it's just, it's really changed and really just exploded. And there's so much more to cover now than there was in 2012, when it felt like an essential beat that we should be covering at the Journal Sentinel.
How much do you think word of mouth amongst musicians plays as a factor into growing our scene? Because we talk a lot about development and all the venues that have popped up. And then, of course, people like yourself or over at Milwaukee Record or Shepherd Express writing about this also gets that word out there. But how much do you think artists just saying to someone who they know have been thinking about maybe touring here and saying, oh, yeah, you're going to want to go there. I got a great response.
Yeah, I think especially on the club level, there is some of that where people are networking, or there's definitely a lot of touring acts in Milwaukee that are doing a very DIY style and going out and making networks and connecting with other people, and then people come here. And you know, and there's, especially for certain levels, like Radio Milwaukee is a big champion for like artists that might play on that station that might help, you know, with some of those kind of booking decisions. There's all sorts of factors. And then, you know, on the big level, you've got what's changed since I started was you know, FPC Live, which is part of Frank Productions, they're in Madison. You know, when I started, they were kind of doing some shows here and there in Milwaukee. That's really changed a lot, because now Live Nation, which is the world's largest concert player, they own a majority stake in Frank Productions and a big stake in FPC Live. And so, you know, basically because Live Nation is so huge, there's a lot of big tours that, you know, basically FPC Live will be the local promoter for a lot of those like Live Nation tours. So that's why we're seeing so much more stuff at like Pfizer Forum. Like, it's just, you know, it's very dramatic how many shows are at Pfizer Forum every year compared with what the Bradley Center had. And mm-hmm. They very quickly kind of eclipsed the Bradley Center in terms of the show count. And part of that is the industry just growing. I mean, there's the touring industry has just kept growing and growing and growing. There's been much more interest in demand of shows, and that's led to a lot of issues with ticket pricing. But at the same time, there's not just that. It's also been new venues and you know, new untapped potential in the market on that level, too.
Music and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Piet Levy, with me on Reporter's Notebook. I want to transition a bit now to your process. When you go out to a show and you're going in mind with, all right, I'm going to this one specifically to capture the environment and write my thoughts about this. First of all, what does the Piet Levy kit look like when you go to a show? Because it's a little bit different, I'd have to imagine, than for someone like myself. If I'm going to a press conference, I walk in with my backpack full of whatever, and I just lay it out. If you're Rachel Bernard, you're a colleague at the Journal Sentinel, and you're doing a restaurant review, you walk in, you bring what you need to, and you do what you do. For someone like you, depending on the venue, I have to imagine, if you're just sitting in the general audience to capture in a show, you can only bring in what they'll let you bring in, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I go in very lean, so I'll go in with like a notepad and a couple pens, because usually, you know, sometimes a pen will just run out of ink, maybe 2 notepads, earplugs. Those are very important. I've got very high quality earplugs. Very lucky that I was able to do that, to get those after a rough experience at the very beginning.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I was at a show and I just got some horrible sound bleed from it was a South by Southwest show. It was like my first year. Okay. And my ear was like ringing for like weeks. Ooh. And I was like, I got to get like good.
I've had a few of those after some radio of shows here in Milwaukee. Before they adjusted recently some of their acoustics and also finally have air conditioning in there. But back in the day, definitely was coming back day after going, what's going on here?
Yeah, so I got some good earplugs, going with the notepads, going with the pens. And then, yeah, I'm taking notes on during the show. You know, I have a system where I'm kind of writing down what the song is. I'll you know, fold the page for each song, so I know kind of each which section. I'll kind of make a special note if it's like a song that I think we're going to end up, you know, a performance we're going to end up writing about in the review. If something really stands out to me or something said, if we are allowed to have your phone out, I'll, you know, record commentary that artists might make or do little clips as well to kind of reference back later. That's kind of the process essentially. And I'll be like listening to, you know, a lot of their music in advance and kind of processing my thoughts about what they're trying to convey in their albums or with their set list or whatever it might be too.
Yeah, when you mentioned the phone video, I think relatively recently of when the Brewers beat the Cubs in Game 5 of the NLDS and Mumford & Sons was playing at Fiserv and the whole arena erupted during what, as you wrote, was a relatively quiet song, not one that the crowd would usually be jumping, pumping their fists to. And all of a sudden, Fiserv is full of a bunch of cheering voices, and he's got to mention, like, did you do it? And then there's that raucous crowd.
Yeah, and that's what I'm looking for, too. I mean, that's what's so special about live music is that, yes, the artist might have the same set list at show after show, and some they might blend in with another show. But then you will have those kind of interesting moments like that with Mumford & Sons. Or I remember, like, a Jack White review I did years ago that really kind of took off because he left the stage without doing Seven Nation Army and the crowd. Ooh. Yeah. And the crowd just wasn't going to leave. The lights were on. Things were unplugging. The crowd was singing and they just would not budge. And they did come back and plug things in. And like it was insane. And that was like a very rare kind of moment that I think because of that, that review kind of really took off. And so there's moments like that. Or Miley Cyrus at Summerfest, she's not even doing shows that often. But when she did Summerfest, she talked about having she admitted to the crowd she felt like a panic attack was coming on during the middle of the set. And she had this really kind of profound speech about that. And, you know, those are special things that you might only get at a, you know, at a show in, you know, in Milwaukee in those cases. So it's really important, I think, to cover that kind of stuff. And music is just so – it just connects, especially at a time where there's so much division. Music is so special to people. And I'm so appreciative of being able to cover this and to get such great feedback from readers who really care about the music that comes to our city, the music coming out of our city.
You sort of laid it out there, and I did want to ask what you thought the role of the music reviewer is in modern media, specifically with what you do, where you are there, boots on the ground, taking things in. I think when a lot of people think of music reviews, especially in the context of nowadays, they think of someone on a YouTube channel, like an Anthony Fantano, for example, with an album, spouting off thoughts about the tracks, giving it a rating, and then moving on to the next piece. But as someone in your position will sure attest to, there's much more to it than that.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm going into review, I'm thinking about, it's all written from my perspective. There's definitely going to be bias in there. But I'm going in with trying to give it all a fair shake and really taking in what the crowd is doing, especially for like a live review and how the crowd is kind of reacting to certain things and why that may be the case, what the artist is doing that's really kind of conveying something or creating this big emotion from a crowd. You know, I'm thinking about like Jelly Roll when he came through at the amphitheater a couple years ago. There was like, you know, there was just men just sobbing next to me. And I was just like, and I felt like my role there was to like figure out, okay, what's going on here with him as a person, with him as an artist, what he's saying, what he's singing that is allowing, you know, men, you know, and you might have stereotypes about, you know, men and expressing your emotion, especially like in the country music and like harder rock, which is what he does. But men are sobbing at the show openly. And I thought that was very moving. And so I was really trying to, with that review, for instance, try to go into what is going on here that, you know, that it's connecting so much. So I take that into account, too. I'm not I don't feel like, you know, sometimes I mean, I am presenting my own opinion on things, but I'm also going in with eyes open and ears open.
Music and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Piet Levy, with us on Reporter's Notebook. I want to shift now to, as I mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, festivals. It was just announced this past week that the city of Milwaukee is getting two new festivals at Henry Meyer Festival Park over the next couple of years. You got the Freshwater Food and Wine Festival that's starting next year. And then I wanted to get your thoughts on Rock and Roll Fest, which is coming in 2027. They're both going to be in September, And you've written about how that outdoor season is widening and widening as we seem to get warmer and warmer fall months. But Rock and Roll Fest specifically, I think in Wisconsin we have a lot of rock fests, like Rock Fest or Rock USA that used to be in Oshkosh back in the day. How is that appetite for what, and it's a little subjective what rock and roll is in 2025, but is that appetite there? I mean, it must be.
Yeah, I think there definitely is that. And there's appetite for live music, and there's a lot of events out there, and some do well and some don't, and festivals come and festivals go. I think what you're seeing at Mayer Festival Park, though, is, you know, they are very committed to trying to utilize that park as much as possible, to have as more events there. That seems to be like a really big mission there now. So there's a lot of focus on that right now. And I think that's what we're going to start seeing more in the coming years, is more things kind of come up, and maybe some will not stick, but some might. So there's just a lot of interest in events. And, you know, I wrote about this too, where like Summerfest, you know, used to be when Summerfest was in town, there was basically nothing in town. Everything kind of shut down. Now you'll have Summerfest go head-to-head against, you know, a couple years ago you had a Kenny Chesney Stadium concert the same day at American Family Field, the same day that you had SZA at American Family Insurance Amphitheater and Summerfest. So now you're just seeing just much more stuff out there. And generally, a lot of those, like that night, for instance, Kenny Chesney basically sold out. SZA sold out. Summerfest did well. You know, it can work, especially if there's enough demand, and there is a lot of demand. Now, some things may not work, and they may not have the attendance they need to kind of be able to get the ROI to keep it going. But I think they're going to keep trying because they do see interest there, and they want to maximize that revenue.
I think I definitely noticed that with Festa Italiana was one of the ones I think that I was worried that they were, because of those declining numbers, and admittedly, it was, we were getting those numbers in the year post-2020,
sure.
So little bit of a slant there, but they definitely seemed like this was their last stretch. Now, just subjectively, I think they've done very well since they've reorganized a little bit of when and how they run things. It seems to be doing okay now.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of events that are still going on and still will continue to go on and still continue to grow. You know, I think, and basically, these event organizers are going to do what they can until they can't really do it. Mm-hmm. You know, the question that kind of comes up is, how can there be this many arena shows? How can there be the Harley-Davidson Festival now every year? It used to be every 5 years. How can there be these additional festival things, you know, additional pavilion shows at the BMO Pavilion, additional amphitheater shows? Now we're going to have Landmark Credit Union Live. That's a new venue. It's going to be 4,500 capacity opening in the Deer District in February. How can that exist on top of the Rave, on top of the Miller High Life Theater and the Riverside Theater? And it's a lot.
Not to mention all the smaller venues. Think like a Cactus Club, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah, it's a lot. And it's just grown and grown and grown. And I feel like I wrote a lot of stories about, can the market sustain this? And a lot of times, you know, whenever I talk to promoters about that or venue operators, they're like, yeah, absolutely. We're going to keep going. And I think this is showing that they have. Now, not all these shows are winners. Not all these festivals may stick around, but they're going to try to push it until the numbers don't really make sense. But I think in a lot of cases, the numbers are making enough sense that they can go on like this.
How chaotic is Summerfest? Whether it's now the 3-weekend model or when it was 11 days before, just how crazy for someone like you is that particular period of the year?
It's really it's a really busy time. It's kind of the big Super Bowl or whatever kind of for coverage for me. There's a lot of planning that goes into that, a lot of setting up for like figuring out what artists we're going to cover, figuring out the scheduling of that, coordinating with our freelance writers, coordinating with our photographers, coordinating with Summerfest in terms of they provide photos too for things we can't get to with our photographers, figuring out what kind of coverage we're doing around all of that, you know, and then there's always picks and there's need to know guides, and then there's breaking news throughout the festival or something might happen that we need to kind of jump on. There's a lot going on around Summerfest. But at this point, like, I'm so proud of the team that we work with, and we work with some great freelance writers, great editors, great photographers, great videographers. And from that team, there's some that have been there, you know, pretty much every year, and there's some people that kind of come and go. But, you know, they know what they're doing. They do it so well. And you know, we just work together so well that it does feel like there's always room for improvement. But I feel like very proud of the kind of coverage that we get to do. And it's very comprehensive coverage, and we could always do more. But I'm just really proud of what we are doing. And so it's a real privilege to be able to cover it. And it means a lot to readers. Readers really resonate with that festival still. I mean, it's Summerfest is different now. Like I said, there's much more competition. There's more out there than when I started. When Summerfest would roll through, it was the 11 days. And, you know, there's just a lot of like emptiness around it. It's very different now, but it still definitely connects with our readers and connects with the city. And it's important to cover it.
What's the most common question a reader will give you about Summerfest, and why is it, when will they go back to 11 days?
It's probably that one. Yeah. No, people did love the 11-day format, and they, you know, probably stick to tradition a lot. I mean, there's definitely a lot of that with Summerfest, and, you know, so people really, really did love it. I don't think we're going to go back there. I mean, maybe, but, you know, for now, for the foreseeable future, we're not. And I think that makes a lot of sense because they are going into three different weekends. They can kind of work with, you know, there's a little more flexibility there. They are probably cutting some costs by cutting out some of the lower attendance days. From a coverage perspective, I appreciate more rest. it is very tiring to kind of cover Summerfest. Mm-hmm. And to have those breaks in between, I think, is probably good for – I mean, I feel good for me physically doing that, but also I'm sure for the staff at Summerfest as well to, like, have those breathers. So it does make a lot of sense, the new format. But we'll see how long that sticks around for, too. That could also change. We'll see.
Before I let you go, Piet, I want to just ask you now, as you look into your crystal ball, we've talked about the health of our scene. We've talked about the amount of venues we have, the amount of opportunities we have to go see music. If you are someone coming up in music, give your pitch for coming to Milwaukee, being a part of what we're building here in our scene, especially if you're a young up-and-coming artist specifically. Pitch, like, why Milwaukee and why now?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is such an exciting time. I can't imagine a more exciting time to cover music than I'm blessed to do right now. There's so much great music coming out from our local musicians, you know, with technological innovations and sharing through Bandcamp or Spotify or whatever it might be, and working on music at your home with software or whatever. There's so much more music being produced and coming out of Milwaukee, first of all. And that's really incredible and really exciting. And there's, you know, some amazing creative stuff that I think just the more you have of that, the more vibrant the city feels. So that's really exciting to see. And then, it's a good city to be in terms of, like, you know, costs. Like, there are some artists who were in, like, kind of more expensive cities to, like, live in, and there's better cost management there. You're also kind of in a good Midwest hub. I mean, that's also why we see, I think, a lot of artists kind of come in from Chicago that are doing additional dates, or we get a lot of country artists that come through that are kind of starting off from Nashville because it's not that far from Nashville. There's just so many, like, benefits to that. I think it's a city that has proven that, you know, I remember talking to one expert at Polestar who feels like the city's, like, kind of punching above its weight in terms of how many things that they offer. To be able to have Summerfest and then to be able to have all these arena shows and to be able to have such a robust club schedule, street festivals, you know, new venues that are coming. I mean, there's just so much going on. There's so much to choose from. And I think that makes living in the city incredibly exciting. It just makes life better. Music makes life better. So there's just a lot to celebrate about what's going on in Milwaukee.
Music and entertainment reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Piet Levy, with me on Reporter's Notebook. Piet, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.